organizers not yet here. So I need to do this FOIP announcement, which reminds everybody that aside from being broadcast in six places, we also, well, maybe it's five, we also are recording this session for future access to the Research Center's website. And I see Robin Jack has arrived in the nick of time, so we would like to welcome Joseph and get everything rolling for our first multi-site, multi-media talk.
Presentation mode.
Do we have to give him a mic? What's happening
here? No, he's got a mic.
Okay.
Yep. Cool. Maybe if no one else has prepared a little introduction, just a few words would be in order, since it's an honor to have Joseph Boyden as our inaugural Athabasca University Writer in Residence. Joseph has been exchanging creative writing pieces with our students. It's a huge contribution. I don't think it's unknown to anyone, but we may as well repeat that Joseph Boyden is an internationally best-selling writer of fiction and creative nonfiction. His first book he's going to talk to us about today actually was either awarded or selected for recognition in five major categories. His second novel, Through Black Spruce, won the prestigious Giller Award. So it's a huge honor. And the last little thing I'd like to say by way of introduction is actually to thank some of the people who helped to organize this residency, including Madeline Dumas, who in the creative writing area, and Tara Friesen from Advancement, some of the colleagues in CLL. I'd like to thank all the people that organized today, including Mike and the University of New Orleans. Welcome to all our creative writing students who are online, and it's great to have you here, and I'd like to turn it over to Joseph.
It's a real honor and pleasure for me as well. And so I want to say welcome to the 21st century. This is the first release for this kind of thing. I'm actually quite the luddite when it comes to too much technology. I do have my email down and my commitment brushing to be working well. It's been a great number of months so far with the students talking back and forth about the work. And I think they're really looking forward to getting to Edmonton shortly, and then returning going to a few other of the campuses here in Alberta later on in late winter, early spring. Today is not a talk, but I was asked to give a
video on the audio through video conference.
I
lens for some reason it would be on camera. That's
where the chief behind it. I've been working with my first novel was historical 3 days ago, and the historical bug has gotten me again, and I'm working on a new book, a new novel that is historical as well, and I'm actually going to read a little bit of it to you today, for 10 pages or so. This will be a first, actually, so I hope you guys enjoy it. The idea of writing a historical novel is pretty tempting, I think, for many authors. I think a lot of writers think of this, maybe I should try writing one. And there's a lot of reasons why it is. It's an enticing kind of thing. There's bound to be lots of subject matter that's often very juicy and full of the good stuff of fiction. You'll find deceit and betrayal in real life history. You'll find infidelity. You'll find war and murder. You'll find corruption in all of its many forms. And sometimes you might even find a little bit of truth and beauty in history. Certainly historical fiction is a proven seller, and I think this is another reason why so many authors are tempted to try this kind of genre, if you want to call it that. Let's look at a few novels. In Canada, we have two of the Civil Wars, which continues to be a huge seller. Historically, we have Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, or James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans, or Dickens' The Tale of Two Cities. More contemporarily, we have Umberto Eco, The Name of the Rose, or D.L. Doctorow's Ragtime. So in historical novels, audiences love to read them, love to devour them. And that's very tempting for a writer. I think a third reason many authors consider writing historical novels is because such incredible events and characters are already there in real life that are basically ripe for the picking. The adage that real life is stranger than fiction certainly comes to mind when I think of this. When a writer looks back to history for inspiration, he or she often finds ready-made plots and complex characters already laid out for him or her, which again is very tempting. If I know all of this sounds great for a writer, anyone who's a promising writer and wants to try to hand historical fiction, so it's perfect in ways on paper. But is it in reality that straightforward to things out in writing of one? Is it that easy for a writer to do? Of course not. The reality of writing a historical novel is, how shall I say, a long, painful, and even torturous task. The sheer volume of information and research one must wade through is simply daunting. Just today, for example, I got a ring on my doorbell 3 this morning, and there's the FedEx guy with literally 20 titles I just bought from Amazon.com in pursuit of my latest research. And then the troubling thing is, once you've completed all of this research, that's when the real work actually begins. Writing good historical fiction is not just simply spitting out facts and names and dates. The author's job is to somehow breathe life into the dead, to bring to life long ago people and events. So one of the biggest problems to overcome is, once you've collected all that research, the irony is that you must just throw it away. You must write as if you've never read a history book. The writing must appear fresh and alive and anything but weighed down with facts. Ultimately, a good historical novel must feel, ironically, completely contemporary, and that's no mean feat. On a more personal level, many years ago, as a young man, I embarked on the journey of writing my first novel. I was naive, I'll admit it. I was young and energetic. I was clearly a bit of a masochist to boot. I wanted my first novel to play out on a grand scale. I wanted it to be epic. I wanted it to be, you've got it, historical. Before I'd written that novel, I had written a collection of stories called Born with a Tooth. And that was my first success as an author, actually publishing a book. And then it came time to write the first novel. And for anyone who's a writer, trying to think of that first novel is always a big kind of scary thing. And I wanted this. I wanted to make a splash. I wanted to do something big. And so I chose World War I. As my setting, as my backdrop, as my canvas. A lot of people ask, why World War I? This is very strange. This is a different century. It seems so long ago. I think there's a number of reasons. I grew up the son of a Second World War veteran who was a doctor. His name was Raymond Wilfrid Gordon, and he was the most highly decorated doctor in the British Empire in World War II. He wouldn't talk about his own experiences very much, but he talked about his older brother's experiences in the trenches of World War I, and that always fascinated me. Along with that, we spent a lot of time on a reserve in the Soxing Reserve in Georgian Bay, Ontario, and I grew up with a number of Ojibwe children named the Pegamagabos. And they always told me stories of their great-grandfather, who was a sniper, an Indian sniper, in the trenches of World War I. And so I had those stories from a very early age, just fascinated me. And so as I grew up, these things never left me. The idea of my father, the myth of my father, and the legend of my father, the legend of Francis Pegamagabo. And it's just kind of swirling around me. And I thought, what perfect place. I thought, a novel has to be interesting, number one. It's got to be as interesting for the writer as it is for the reader, for the writer to lose faith in writing. Because, well, what is going to keep my interest? What's really interesting? What excites me? And I went back to this idea of Indian snipers roaming the trenches of France and Belgium in the First World War. I'd always been an avid reader, and I thought I knew something of World War I. As it turns out, my knowledge fairly scratched the surface. There's many different ways, I think, to research a historical novel. One, I have some friends, Andrew Davidson is a friend who comes to mind with The Gargoyle. He'll sit down and do all of his research first. He'll read everything, has extensive notes, he'll pile things, sometimes for a few years, even before he starts writing. And then there are those who jump in and do the research as they go. With me, I thought I had enough of a grasp of First World War and its history to research as I write this. So that's what I tried. But as I mentioned, I quickly realized my knowledge is not all that I thought it was. There's thousands literally of books and documents that deal with the First World War, and so just looking at that huge pile in front of me was a very daunting and scary thing. I had to come up with a game plan for my research, so I was never going to get this novel off the ground. I started writing it and then kind of came to a standstill because I didn't know where to go, especially in terms of research. And so I realized what's really important is when did these kids join the army? When did my two protagonists actually join the army? And I thought, okay, 1916 makes sense in terms of how long they're going to be over there, etc. And then I realized, okay, well, there are four divisions in the Canadian military. Which division formed in 1916, and I found out it was the 2nd Division. And then the little light bulb started off. I realized this is the kind of one of the positives of writing a historical novel is that there's real life dates and times that I can use as a type of outline. And so I went to the Canadian history books and found out where the 2nd Division of the Canadian Army was during the last couple of years of the war, what battles they fought in, what the landscapes were, and I began to realize this is how I'm going to do my research for this book. In part, the historical research is to follow the 2nd Division. So suddenly I have a bit of a plot outline, which is very exciting for me. And one of my most important, I think, breakthroughs was realizing that my characters had never been to war. I was very, as a writer, a young writer who had never been to war himself, how was I going to imagine this? And then I realized one day, well, my characters are from the far north of Ontario. They've never been to war, obviously, and they've never even been to Europe. And neither had I at that point in my life. And so I almost became my characters in a way, seeing for the first time with wide eyes what they were seeing. And I realized that if I just kept this approach, it would get me into the skin of these characters and what they're experiencing. And in essence, I was going on this journey with them for the first time together. We, the three of us, were going on this. And finally, when writing a historical novel, despite all the research you can do, despite the hundreds and hundreds of hours of writing, sometimes what you really need is luck, being in the right place at the right time. I remember I had been, again, at a standstill in my research. I was a bit lost, didn't know where to go. I was traveling from home in Toronto back to New Orleans to get back on teaching again. And I took a bus down to St. Catharines and was going to take a train from there. And I had a couple of hours to burn. And I saw this big book warehouse that actually had a sign on it saying books for sale. I thought, oh, this is huge. Maybe they'll have something on the First World War that I can read on the train. So I walk into this huge warehouse full of books of every type and sort. And I find a secretary for this place way in a corner. And I ask her, might be a strange request, but do you have any books on World War I by chance? Especially dealing with the Canadian Army. And this woman looks at me and goes, well, yes, I do. And she stood up and led me to this fantastic row of books that I'd never seen before, all about the Canadian Army and the First World War. And one man's name in particular was on a number of the spines of this book, and of these books, and his name was James R. Steele. And so I'm looking at these books, and the woman kind of smiles and says, who is this James Steele guy? Is he still alive? It's quite prolific in it. Knowledge, obviously, of the history of the First World War in Canada. And you go, no, he's alive, he's my husband. What an incredible coincidence is this. So I bought every book of his that I could, and I said to him, I'm a young writer and trying to write my first novel, so old and one, is there any chance, do you think, that your husband might contact me? Or if I approached him with a few questions, one or two questions, they're still absolutely, and she gave me their phone number. And so I went home and read these books, which are incredibly enlightening for me, and just packed to the gills with information that I needed. And I got up the nerve to call this guy. And I was expecting this very kind of proper professor type. And what I get upset is this veteran, this former veteran from the 1950s with a beard and tattoos and a former auto worker of all things. And we really hit it off wonderfully. And he became, for me, Jim became this incredibly important source and way of checking and fact-finding. I could email request him, and he would break me back pages of information, all kinds of fascinating information, informative little tidbits that we've never gotten anywhere else. And so this is the kind of luck I'm talking about if you're up on a discovery of writing historical novels, finding those people, not being afraid to approach those people. He and I remain dear friends to this day. I once told him, Jim, you've been so incredible to me. If this book ever takes off, if it ever sees the light of day and gets published, and I make a few bucks, I'm going to take you to Europe with me, because Jim had never even been to Europe. His fascination with the First World War stemmed from his grandfather being a soldier in the French Legion. At that time. But Jim had never been able to get over to see where his grandfather actually fought. And lo and behold, my book did take off. I'm very lucky and very grateful that it became a bestseller in a number of countries around the world. And so I one of the greatest days of my life was calling Jim and saying, yeah, pack your bags for one of yours together. And he and I and my son jetted off to France and Belgium and spent a couple of weeks wandering the trenches and then finding the places where Jim's grandfather fought. It was an incredible experience. And so that's a really, really important aspect, is being willing to take a chance and talk to people. Once again, the historical muse is calling in the last novel, True Black Spruce, is contemporary, but there's something about the historical. Once it gets into you, it's been hard to shake. And so I decided that this next novel I'm going to write is a historical novel. I'm clearly a sucker for punishment, is how I put it. To make matters worse, this time that I've decided to write about is more than 450 years ago, and it deals with a people who are all but banished. But more on that momentarily. To speak about me as a writer, just very briefly, and the thematics that I tend to find, there's often so much misunderstanding and confusion and even anger when it comes to our larger society, trying to understand the many First Nations cultures of Canada. Why do those Indians continue to live on isolated reserves in squalid conditions, people will ask? Why do they not just join the 21st century society? Why are so many of these people messed up? Why can't they just be white? It's a theme that's developed over the years in my writing, both in my fiction and nonfiction. It's that I've always wanted and tried to bring to light a specific First Nation worldview, the Anishinaabe worldview, to try and show a bigger audience a little about where some First Nations thinking and actions and views and philosophies come from. The Ojibwe worldview is very different from the Western. I think most Canadian Indian worldviews are very different than their Western counterparts. My mother is a Métis woman of Ojibwe and Scottish descent, and so her people are my people, the Anishinaabe. And I've often seen complete misunderstanding from Western people sometimes on decisions Anishinaabe people might make, or the way they choose to live, or their thinking. Let me share something very briefly with you that I think sums up for me the difference between the Western worldview and the Ojibwe worldview. In the Western world, we look at nature and the elements and the earth as hard to do with what we want. Trees are there for us to cut down, to burn, for heat, to build houses with. Water is there for us to drink or to utilize in any way we choose. Animals are there for our taking. Deer, moose, any kind of domesticated animal, all of these, the earth is there as ours to use. The Bible says so. Man is in charge is the keeper of the earth, is on the top of the totem pole, to use a really racist analogy. What the Ojibwe world view is absolutely the opposite. Man is not at the top of the food chain. Man is actually at the bottom of the totem pole, at the bottom of the food chain. If you think about it, we need everything on this earth in order to survive. We need water, we need food, we need the trees, we need simple rocks. We need everything to survive that is placed on this earth. But what on this earth, the Ojibwe asks, needs humans to survive? And the answer is really nothing in this world needs us to survive at all. In fact, many species would be better off. The earth would probably be better off without our very encroaching habits. And so therefore, when you'll see an old elder kill to catch a fish or shoot a moose, he'll thank it and put the backbone in front of the way of thanking it. And this is to show that animal that we understand that we are not at the top, we are at the bottom. And so this is one example of how the two world views differ so tremendously. And this is what I try to illustrate in my own writing. And so what better way to continue this exploration than to head back almost 500 years to ground zero in Canada, some of the first contact between First Nations and Europeans. My new novel deals with the Jesuits of France making contact with and attempting to Christianize the Indian tribes, especially the Great Lakes Indian tribes of Ontario. I think that this might be a wonderful chance to actually illustrate two very different ways of seeing the world. Ultimately, I want to finish by saying, before I do this little reading, I believe that good historical fiction has some good connection to the writer, and certainly the writer to the subject matter. And good historical fiction must feel in some way contemporary, or better put, must have some connection, some reverberation in the contemporary world. And that said, I wouldn't mind, if you're up for it, I wouldn't mind giving you a short reading from this novel. It's the first time doing it, so I'm a little nervous to do it, and I do hope you enjoy it. Really, all you need to know is this is about the Jesuits' first contact with First Nations people in Canada. So yet untitled. We had magic before they came, but who to blame when that was seized? Loss shouldn't be weighed in such a way. Who then to blame for all of this? For all the bitter little victories that come with cutting your arms to ribbons or clamshells, strangling yourself in the dark corner of your tent. Yes, certainly we had magic. We believed. Oh, did we believe. That is why when the crows arrived, they thought of us at first as animals. We lived in a physical world that frightened them, and we hunted beasts they'd only had nightmares of, and we consumed the magic that the crows were bred to fear. We breathed what they feared. The crows watched intently as crows are prone to do. And when they cawed that our magic was unclean, we laughed, took a little offense, even killed a few of them and plucked their feathers for our hair. And we lived on. But that word, unclean, that word somehow like an illness, like its own magic, it began to grow. Only very few of us saw that coming. And so maybe this is the story of those few. When Jean awakes from his few minutes of troubled sleep, his teeth chatter so violently he bites his swollen tongue. He spits right into the snow and tries to rise, but his body has seized. The old Huron, the one who kept the group walking all night around the big lake rather than across it because of a stupid dream, stands above him with a thorn club. Although Jean knows little of their language, he understands the words the old man spits and forces himself to roll when the club swings toward him. The thorns bite into Jean's back, and the violent curses that pour from his mouth make the group of Hurons watching intently cover their mouths with laughter. They'd all be screaming with glee, pointing and holding their bellies if they weren't being hunted right now. With a low sun rising and the air so cold, the noise travels. They're all long fed up with the young Mohawk girl who won't stop whimpering. Her face is swollen from slaps, and when Jean looks to her lying in the snow, he fears that they killed her while he slept. Not long ago, just before night, they'd all stopped to rest. The old man and his handful of hunters stopping as if they planned it out in advance, the pack of them collapsing into each other for the heat. They whispered among themselves, and a couple of the hunters' eyes glanced over to Jean. Although he couldn't decipher their rushed speech, he knew they talked of leaving him here, probably with the girl who at that moment sat with her back to a birch, staring as if in a dream. Or maybe they talked of killing Jean and the girl. The two of them had slowed the rust off down all night, and despite Jean trying to walk quietly, he stumbled in the black through the thick brush and tripped over fallen trees buried in the snow. At one point, he'd removed his snowshoes, they were so clumsy, but he sank up to his hips in his next step, and one of the hunters had to pull him out, biting him hard on the face when he finally accomplished the deed. Now the snow covering their legs glows the color of a robin's egg as sun tries to break the clouds. If John lives through this day, he will always remember to pay attention to the tickle of dryness at the back of his throat at this moment, the wine like a bad headache coming. Caesar began to walk to the girl to offer her comfort if she's still alive, when the dog's howl breaks the silence, the excitement in his picking up their scent making John want to throw up. John forgets how his toes have begun to blacken, that he's lost so much weight he can't support his gaunt frame for long, that his chest is filled with a sickness that's turned his skin yellow. He knows dogs, though, as in his old world, these are one of the few things in this new one who bring him comfort. And this one's still a long way away, its voice traveling easy in the frozen air. When Jean bends to help the girl up, he sees the others have already left, have disappeared into the shadow of the trees and thick brush. His panic at being left alone to those chasing him, the ones who will make sure he dies a slow death so painful he now weighs taking his own life, is so powerful, he knows exactly what he must do. He will strip naked and he will walk out onto the lake. He calculates how long it will all take. The first 10 minutes of the dog's race closer and closer to him will certainly be the most painful. His skin will at first feel like he's on fire, like Jean is being boiled in a pot. There's only one thing more painful than the first minutes of freezing, and it's the thawing out, every tendril of the body screaming for the pain to stop. But Jean won't have to worry about that. He will lie in the frozen lake and allow the boiling of the cold to consume him. After those first handful of minutes, the violent shaking won't even be noticed. For the sharp stabs of pain in the forehead will come, and it will travel deeper until it feels his brain is being prodded with fish spines. And when the dogs are within a few minutes of reaching him, Jean will suddenly begin to feel a warmth creeping over him. His body will continue with hard seizures, but his toes and his fingers and his testicles will stop burning. He'll begin to feel a sense of, if not comfort, then relief, and his breathing will be very difficult, and this will cause panic, but the panic will slowly harden to resolve. And when the dogs are on the lake and racing toward him, jaws foaming and teeth bare, John will know that even this won't hurt anymore, as he slips into a sleep that one cannot awaken from. As the dogs circle him, he will try to smile at them, bare his teeth too, and know that although his eyes are frozen shut, that the dogs will begin to eat him. But he will not feel himself being consumed, will be like Christ as he gives his body so that others might live. This thought of giving lives John just enough for him to pick up the girl and begin walking her away from the lake's edge. If she's alive after all, won't her people, his pursuers, consider sparing him? He will keep her alive, not just because this is what God demands, but to save himself. The thought of this betrayal of Christ's wishes feels more an intellectual quandary than what he imagines should physically cause pain to his heart. He'll worry about that later. For now, he follows the other's footsteps as best he can, his thick black robe catching on the woven branches and nettles. The bush so thick he wonders how it is that the many follow, and the ones who follow him are not part animals, even have some black magic that gives them abilities that seem beyond the natural. John's God seems very far away here in this cold hell, and the Monsignor's attempts to prepare him last year before his journey to the New World seem ridiculous in their naivete. He will face great danger. He will most certainly face death. He will question Jesus' mercy, even his existence. This is Lucifer whispering in your ear. Lucifer's fires are cold. There is no warming your body and your soul by them. But Monsignor doesn't have any idea what true cold is, John realizes, as he allows himself and the girl to be swallowed by the darkness of the same trees that the cold sun is trying to penetrate. Bird stops to look up as the sun breaks cloud. The puffs of his breath shimmer in the first light. The sun will illuminate all of it. Bird knows this most of all. The sun will show the dog hunters who pursue exactly where to go, will show them how many and what condition his ones are in, and especially that they drag a crow with them. The sun today is not a friend. If they all die today, it will be because of it. And the sun won't give real heat for 3 more moons, so the sun is shit today. And that crow who tries to follow is shit too, and the girl. Taking her was a bad idea, and Bird knew it then like he knows it now. He's an old man and still hasn't learned to speak when his guest tells him. He orders Fox to set a sinew snare where the path narrows, just high enough to strangle the first of the Mohawk dogs that follows. With any luck, the others will stop and be hungry enough to tear apart their friends, for surely the dogs have not been eating much at all the last while. Sort of thing to yesterday when his group stumbled across a smaller group of Mohawks, both parties pursuing the same deer. Luck and the bit of tobacco we'd offered to the Star people the night before allowed Bird to find his enemy's tracks first, and he and his men followed nimble and fast. By the drag of the Mohawks' notions, he knew they were close to starving, and by the lack of dog prints, he knew what their last meal had been. Bird tied the crow to a tree and then attacked the other hunting party when he found them in his bully. It was almost too easy. They put arrows through the first two, and the two men left could barely put up a fight when Bird and the soldiers walked to them. They didn't even seem to care when Fox clubbed down one of the women who bit him hard through his hide. Bird himself walked up to the biggest man, already singing his death song, and swung his sword club into the Mohawk temple, angry he wasn't willing to fight for his woman. Bird remembers having to stand on the Mohawk's head to wrench free his weapons. Yes, he's old, but he's still very strong. The only one as tall as Bird is that crow, who he can now hear stumbling through the snow and whining, trying to catch up to them. He's a big crow, thick through the chest and clearly strong, but is he not the most awkward human Bird has ever met? He is a holy one, though. Bird has watched him pray to his Manitou for hours at a time, summoning wood and silver beads that Bird thinks he wants to possess so he understands their power. Bird took no pleasure yesterday in killing the last two women. Even though he ordered Fox to do it, his order is the same as if he himself had done it. Fox cut their throats with his knife so they'd go quick, despite the taunts of Sturgeon and Hawk and Deer to make it slow. When the three called Fox a woman for making the first leave so fast, he positioned the second woman, who was quite pretty, so the blood from her throat sprayed their faces. That shut them up. And despite feeling badly for the dead, Bird laughed. For all Bird knew, it was this group who was responsible for the slow and awful deaths of his wife and two daughters. There had been no peace since. Bird no longer cares for peace. As they gathered a few Mohawk possessions that were worth taking, Bird caught the sound of a sniffle behind him in a clump of cedar. He didn't turn immediately, for he was too tired not to chase through the forest but was clearly a child. Fox made eye contact with him, and then walked away and around behind the cedar, circling it in a wide arc and cutting off the child's escape. He emerged with the girl in his arms, her body as straight and stiff as if she'd frozen solid. She stared ahead with eyes that didn't seem to see but saw everything. What is this that stopped Bird from killing her, allowing the others to suggest he could take her as a servant? She was beautiful and would only become more so in the next few years. He and his group should not have followed their own tracks back out to the certainty of direction gives away too much to an enemy who wishes to learn. By late last night, the certainty that a much bigger group of Mohawk had found the killing ground and were following was clear to Bird. It's not that he could hear them or see them. The cold air took on another quality, though, and the hair at the back of his neck had begun to stick out, tickling him in an annoying way, like a mosquito. Yes, it's like a mosquito, isn't it, buzzing your ear and waking you from a deep sleep. That's when Bird hurried his pace last night, and the soldiers knew then, too, exactly in the speeding up of pace that they all now face. And despite her slowing them down all night, this morning as her people pursue them, Bird still doesn't regret taking her. She contains something powerful. This has become more and more clear in the last hours. Bird and the others slap her to keep her awake, and even if she does slow them all down, all of them are willing to take this great risk because of the promise of what is inside her. And if the crow is able to not just keep up with the hunters, but keep the girl alive too, he will have proved to Bird that both of them have something inside them that is worth studying. Now that the crow appears through the trees, the girl in his large arms, Bird decides to push forward. It's a good plan. If the Mohawk catch up, they will catch up to the crow first, and when they find their child in his arms, they will celebrate her survival with a feast that ends in the consumption of the crow. Yes, they will send a much smaller party immediately to pursue Bird and his men, but these odds are better than what they now face. Bird points out the presence of the snare to the crow as he stumbles up, breathing heavily. When the crow sits in the snow, the young girl sits again with her eyes staring ahead. Bird and his group stand. The crow's confused expression turns quick to anger, and Bird likes the sign very much. Crow has energy left. Maybe he'll make it through today after all. Bird and his four soldiers walk to where he sees a sharp drop to the creek below. Crouching and leaning back, he slides down the hill on the heels of his snowshoes. Feels like he's flying as he picks up speed to where the creek will offer he and his men a much faster route. he feels happy. A man should feel happy on the day that will be his last. I dreamed all of this. I told my father, but he was too tired, too hungry maybe to listen. I told my mother too, and she too was so tired, so hungry. I see the arrow that strikes my father in the neck before it even flies. I see the red of blood on the snow, how it steams for just a little bit before freezing in something that looks like a soup and suddenly with a shake in the thickest thing. Before my mother bites the small man who's like a lynx or maybe a fox, and he smashes her head so that she falls to the ground and shakes while she dances in the snow. I've already dreamed of her being held roughly by them and finding my eyes as I hide in the theater. She tells me with her eyes that she is going to do something important, and when she does, I am to run as fast as I can and not stop until I find my uncles and my cousins, who aren't too far from him. My mother's eyes flash to me that I will run as fast as I've ever run, and I won't stop until I find my uncles, or I am dead. Her eyes blink to me that if these ones here catch me, I will wish I had died already. And then she bites the man like she's a crazed wolf, and he screams out and begins smashing her in the head with his club, and she flops in the snow like a pipe pulled from a hole in the ice, or maybe a rabbit that has been clubbed, and shakes toward her death, feet thumping the ground. It is a good thing that my father lies dead on the ground near her with an arrow through his neck, or he would not stop until all of them are dead. But he is dead, and my mother shakes toward him, and my oldest brother, who is blind and deaf, doesn't see or hear our mother and father dying, and leaves the world with them, and the big old man clubs him in the head. My whole family shakes on the ground today before leaving me, and this is something I've already dreamed, the shaking of my family in the snow, feeding on something, then vibrating, then humming, then eventually going still. I will not shake into my death, I tell myself in my dream, and I tell myself when I am swallowed up in the arms of the fox man, who has taken behind me and is quick as a lynx, until I go stiff and wait for him to smash me on the head. Instead, he carries me to the big man who has struck down my brother, and as I pass the others who are dead, my father, my mother, my father's two young apprentices, their wives who have squirted blood onto the men who laughed at them, I keep my eyes forward and try not to see any of them, pretend they are my brother who cannot see what he mimics since I can remember that look of seeing nothing and seeing everything. But I do see. I see that my father lies in the snow, a bright ring of red circling his head like a red ring around the moon in autumn, and his arms stretched out from him as if he is pointing with one to where the sun rises, some of the other to where the sun sets. And I see one foot cross over the other as if he can finally relax now that he has slipped through to the other side. I remain stiff, though, believe that if my body stays still and hard as I can make it, that these men will lose interest, and they will think I've turned to wood or ice, and they will leave me in the snow because the weight of me is not worth carrying, especially when my father's brothers and their sons and their dogs find out what has happened. These men who have killed my family, these men I've dreamed of, they better start running now, for my uncles and their sons will pursue them soon, will never stop chasing until they are done with it. And so I'll act heavy and stiff and allow my feet and my arms and my head to catch on the branches as these men try to carry me away. If I stay frozen, they will be forced to eventually drop me. This morning my plan has worked. And I watch my family's killers leave me as soon after my uncle's best dog sings out that he can smell me. But the stinky man, the big one whose face is hairy like a wolf, he bends down to me, and his black clothes smell so bad that I want to throw up, and his breath smells like rotted meat, and the wolf hair on his face and the black clothes on his body scratch me, and there's no way I can stay fit and dead anymore. And just when I open my mouth to scream, when I begin to swing at his face, and claw at his eyes and bite like I watched my mother bite, I see my father, grown tiny and sparkling, hanging on a leather cord from this thing's neck. It's my father lying in the snow, a circle around his head, and his arms stretched out and his feet relaxed when he crossed over the others. My tiny father, as the hairy, stinky man bends to me, arcs toward me, and I watch him come toward me, his face catching the first morning light, and his body meets my lips, and his body feels warm, and I see now that he's still alive because he is warm, and I make a kiss to him as he swims away, and the stinky man picks me up, and I hear my uncle's dog in the distance sing out once more. I'll stop there for now, but that's the beginning of this novel at this point in time. Is there any questions that you more than happy? I know it's a Friday afternoon, I don't keep you too long.
Hello, Joseph. This is Joseph in Edmonton. I went to a Catholic school like you, except it wasn't a Jesuit school like Grey Book, so I imagine that's probably part of that background, this novel. Recently, I've begun to read about the Jesuits and the Jesuit relations, and I found two things that I found I was struck by. A lot of them are writing about their first encounter with the First Peoples, and they're writing about it in a very positive way, as if they're trying to establish a kind of earthly paradise in their missions. And the model they have for this is the Jesuit missionaries in Uruguay. And the other thing that struck me about the Jesuit relations was the fact that some of them, you have a lot of violence in what you read, some of them want to be martyred. You know, some of them that were tortured and escaped to Europe end up wanting to go back to the missions in Canada because they want to be martyred, because that's the way to paradise and happiness. So that's one thing that struck me. And we forget about this after leaving Catholic school, but that's part of our culture. So I'd like you to comment on that. I don't know if you're going to deal with that, but that's an interesting problem we have.
I certainly am. I think the Jesuit relations are just fascinating. They're just so full of amazing kind of historical and sociological information. The Jesuit relations were originally written, obviously, by the Jesuits over in Canada, and then mailed back, you know, slowly overseas to France, where they were published and became bestsellers at the time. People became very hungry to read them each year that they came out. Isaac Jogues is a great example of a Jesuit who was captured by the Iroquois, had his hand cut off as a warning, and they said, go back home and don't come back. He goes back home, decides to head back to judge the Iroquois, capture him again, and say, oh, I didn't know you asked him, so they slowly tortured him to death that time. But it's fascinating, this whole Jesuit thing. The character, the real person that's inspiring this genre is John de Brébeuf. Some of you might have read the novel or seen the movie Black Globe, and it's a good book, and it was a good movie, but it literally kind of scratches the surface of what I'm really going to get at, and that's more of the First Nations kind of perspective of things, which is very difficult. You know, one of the things I didn't mention in my research is that the Western type of research is pretty straightforward. You get your books and you read them and you take your notes and you learn everything you can. But the First Nation research is very different. It's so much of it is based on the oral tradition. And now that there aren't very many Huron left, and the language is not very strong anymore, and it makes it very difficult to find people who can tell you much. And so this is one of the kind of daunting research things that I have. But going back to the Jesuit relations very briefly for a second, is that you can watch some of these Jesuits paint what they come across at the time as heathens and horrible people, and then slowly over time, over the years of the settlement, they become more and more immersed by them and fall in love with them. And you can see this change in their writings and in their reflections. I think John de Brébeuf is a good example of that. He was the first of the Jesuits to go over and learn the language, many of the languages, and you can see him almost becoming Indian in his way of thinking, which I found fascinating.
Okay.
You've spent many years there.
Thank you very much, Joseph. This is Jay Smith. I work with the other Joseph here at Athos University. I just want to preface remarks. I am here to a certain extent being able to live in New Orleans. Despite what it's been through, it's still a wonderful city with wonderful people, and I hope it continues to pull through. My question regards to a comparison between, in a sense, two black spruce with this latest novel. I mean, you mentioned that the importance of history here in terms of formation of your writing, but what I detect in this novel is something also detect in Two Black Spruce, and that is that strong sense of place, the encounter with the North and the climate, and the sense of the necessity of survival and encounter with the elements and perhaps starving. I'm thinking to Black Spruce, the pilot goes out hiding and he's out in the wilderness and he's on the edge and he's not sure if he's going to survive, he's going to make it. And I'm just wondering, for you, where does that sense of place come from? Did that come from your experience in
in Canada, and it seems to come through as a very powerful formative element, no matter whether the novel is contemporary or historical.
Yeah, I think you're right. I have a deep fascination and love and respect for the natural world. And I think that stems from my father and mother making sure, from a very young age, from my birth, that we were out a lot in the wilderness, whether it's on the Great Lakes or Georgian Bay area, every chance we got. So I just fell in love with the natural environment. And even more so, I ended up living in James Bay for a couple of years teaching back in the mid-90s, and the isolation and the true kind of removed type of environment there. You're so far away from anyone else. You can drive out 100 miles and you're so much meaner, and that's it, it's you in the wilderness, and we have to be very careful. That kind of thing fascinates me. And despite my living in New Orleans much of the year, I'm a Canadian writer. I'm not an expert Canadian. I'm a Canadian from New Orleans much of the year. And I get this kind of psychic and geographic distance that seems to serve me well when I write about my country when I look back. And one of the things that always draws me back is the natural environment, no question. Yeah, I appreciate your comments about New Orleans.
Hi, this is Nancy in Edmonton. I'm really intrigued with your use of voice. I see you in this piece using two different voices. You have a narrator and you have a first-person voice. And my question really is, how do you make those choices? When you sit down to write this, is it a natural thing that just happens, or do you think through how the voices are going to work? And how do you make those choices about voice?
That's a really good question. I try not to overanalyze anything in my writing in terms of sit down and plot it out too much. I didn't even realize at first when I changed from that third person of John and the third person of the Huron named Bird to the first person of the young girl until I had done it. I was like, wow, that's interesting. But for some reason, it's working for me right now. If it feels natural and organic to me, then I don't push it. I allow it to percolate. I think my characters have to gain a voice, and then they're almost like children. They're young children right now, and they're slowly growing up, but soon they're going to be able to just let them go, and they're going to be telling me where they're going and what they're doing. So I know it sounds a bit odd, but that's what happens to me in the process of writing a novel over years, is that these characters develop and begin telling me where they're going to go. That's kind of interesting. But yeah, I let the voice, it feels natural for me, and then I just
I just want to add another question to go with that. How much do your historical sources shape that voice? Because I'm thinking, for example, if you're working with text where someone is writing their experience, and I'm coming from the place of being someone who writes history, and trying to move into historical fiction from being an academic historian?
This, again, is a very good question. I think I'm being somewhat, I'm allowing Jean de Brébeuf's writing, certainly, and then the writings of other Jesuits to certainly kind of play into this voice of the Jesuit character in this novel of his character Jean. There's a certain style of speaking, and certainly of seeing the world and questioning what the Indians are doing and trying to continue to hold on to the belief that Christianity and what the Jesuits are doing is the right and proper thing to do. And so certainly the voices of some of these real-life Jesuits will play into this one character of John in terms of, I want to make it feel real as well. And then, I'm still very early in the process of writing this novel, so again, he'll continue to develop. What I foresee of John, the Jesuit, is he's young now, but as the novel progresses, a number of years pass, and he falls into the man he's meant to be, into the Jesuit he's meant to be. This isn't a novel where I plan to chastise the Jesuits for destroying the Huron culture, for wiping out the Huron culture. The Jesuits came into this thinking and believing that what they were doing was the best, which was important and good in God's word. And the Indians believe the same thing, that what they were doing was right. And so it's kind of tragic circumstances that do end up happening, the destruction of a whole race. It wasn't true bad intention. That's what's kind of fascinating to me. And that's where the Jesuit voice is playing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Are there any questions from Calgary?
Don't get obligated.
When might we expect your this novel to be on the shelf so we can read it? I want to know.
Well, I made a promise to my publisher that autumn of 2012 we were still aiming for. And I think this year is going to be an important year for me. And that's part of the reason I'm so thrilled with this writer in residence position. It actually gives me the time to write, which is amazing. And that's a gift that is rare indeed. So we're aiming for autumn 2012, if all goes right. If not, absolutely 2013. Unfortunately, writing a novel is not like creating a record album or something. And it's like, for me anyway, in a long time. And this isn't, by the way, there's going to be a third novel in the trilogy, the Three Day Road trilogy. This isn't the third novel in the trilogy. You guys are, and I have a little secret of mine. I'm going to surprise my reading public by putting out this novel before it puts out the third in the trilogy. But I'm telling you.
Being recorded.
Thanks for that. I was just going to say, I guess we don't see any written questions from the main participants, but I know some of you are writing students and maybe would like to ask questions, but you always, of course, have that email link to Joseph, that'd be all right.
That'd be great. I'd love to hear from
you. Everyone in this room was kind of saying gripping and evocative, so we're kind of waiting for that date, that release date. Really great honor to be the ones to have heard that. Thank you very much for that.
It's my pleasure. Can I ask a leading question? Would you keep reading if you pick up this novel and this is the beginning of it?
Yeah.
No question.
Your point is to say yes.
The we get a fee as a focus.
Unfortunately for our Illuminate attendees, the audio wasn't as clear as we'd like it. It's being retransmitted, so it was being picked up through the speaker. So they may have questions, but they may feel uncertain about how to express them. So this was an experiment for doing video conferencing from a fourth location. But I know I enjoyed the presentation.
One more question. Hi, I'm Nadine. I'm not from a career background. I'm a computer scientist. So this might sound like a strange question. There's one question which is bothering me a lot. Is how important it is to try to portray as true as possible perception of the historical time period of the event. Because you look at any event, especially worse, you have perspectives from, you have a lot of people involved and they have different perspectives, different views. How important it is to try to cover as much perspective as possible, or what is more important, the story, the history, or, I mean, would you actually, would a writer dare to go against the popular opinion?
That's a great question, and yeah, absolutely. I think I will probably do that in this novel. I only realized that after reading it to you today how truly violent it is. What it's not going to be that violent, but I wanted to open the way I imagined this novel opening was this 17th century car chase. And I realized how kind is that if it's too slow and it's really slow and plodding and violent. But getting back to your question, I think that all of those, the history, the reality, the breaking of certain stereotypes, all have to take a role in writing historical novels. But I let characters and what the characters go through dictate what's going to happen. I'm not a writer who says this is going to be my big theme and I'm going to push it through all of these characters and I create them to make the theme. It's the opposite for me. I create characters and stories that I find fascinating. And I know that if I'm on the right track, then naturally themes are going to develop and mature and germinate throughout the novel. And so I don't mind breaking a stereotype if it's called for.
We do have a question from one of our online attendees. Linda Jensen asks, how do you tend to not repeat things in your work or use new terms, new thoughts? Do you just let your imagination go wild?
It's a good question. Yeah, I will. When I do a first draft, I'll try not to edit myself. The editing process comes in the second, third, fourth draft, and when my wife reads it. I'm a really great editor. I'm not going to try to be overly careful with my language. I'll go the extra step if I feel maybe even over the line sometimes, knowing that I'll go back and rein it in for my wife or anything for me. But I try to leave myself really open in early drafts to exploring language and character and thought and letting these things kind of run free before I land them in, if that makes sense.
And this is a question from me, a psychologist. How much of the story's ending do you have in mind when you start off? Do you have a sense of where you're going, or I sense that you use the term organic and that you let your writing lead itself, but do you, in the back of your mind, have a sense of the place that you're heading to, or are you prepared to sort of let the story unfold as the writing dictates?
That's a great question. Again, more often than not, the ending is rather vague. As already mentioned, many of the Jesuits ended in martyrdom, and I'm pretty sure without giving away or ruining John Ben is going to be reaching paradise. Right now, the ending for me is rather, I see it kind of way on the horizon, but it hasn't come into focus yet. The only way for me so far in the novel, the third novel I'm working on, is to start getting on that road and writing closer and closer to it, and hope that that ending does come into the clarity. So for me, it's kind of a vague. I know where I want to get to, but I'm not sure exactly what it's going to look like yet. So I shall find out. Oh, and I want to reiterate with any of my online students to please, if you have any questions or want to chat or whatever, please do that.
Linda Jensen, thank you for the answer and also your wife. Jilda, you may need to speak up a bit. I'm not sure if Joseph can hear you, but we're having trouble as well.
So I'm wondering, how much of that is again, a good question, and how much of this is in here now. This writing that I read to you today is more polished than that first draft. specifically would be, only because I didn't want to read you something that sounded horrible or was repetitive or repetitive. And embarrassing to me as a writer. So since I went back and polished these pages up pretty well, I think. And I thank you very much for the really beautiful compliments about it. I think for me as a writer, my greatest fear is to come off as redundant, as sounding like somebody else, or saying something in a way that we've heard 100 times before. And the steel line, if you remember it, was heard in Tears of the Skin. I'm going to probably end up cutting that because I've heard that before. We've all heard that before. It's that kind of thing. It's like, it'll stick in my craw. As a writer, and this is great for all of you writers, I think when you're editing, read your work out loud. Your ear is going to catch things that you wouldn't catch normally just reading it silently on the page. If you read out loud, and especially to somebody else, you're going to really catch things that bother you, that stick in your claw, that don't feel quite right. That's when you know you've got to go back and examine those sentences or those paragraphs or sometimes those whole chapters to see what the real problem is, what's going on. I'm sorry, I highly urge anyone, and even if you're a creative writer, if you write essays or articles, if you read out loud, you're going to catch so much, your ear will catch you so much that you wouldn't normally by not reading out loud.
Joseph, my name is Adine. I'm in Edmonton, and I also went to Belfast University. I'm fascinated by one thing in this relatively short piece that you've written, that you're basically dealing with four languages. You know, Huron, Mohawk, Ojibwa, where I'm assuming they'll be in there eventually as well, and French, but you write it in English. Have you given that any thought?
I have, and the thing that makes me most nervous about this novel is that in my other writing, I'm writing about a people who are either of my own blood or Cree, for example, which is an Algonquin cousin of the Ojibwe and the Anishinaabe, and so I'm comfortable in the Oji Cree world. If you don't know, there are Huron left, but there's not many, and I'm a little bit nervous to be writing about people who I don't completely know. This is one of the dangers of being a writer, though, and it's one of the things that I'm going to remain very aware of as I go along and find people and talk to people. I know a number of Algonquin people now, Barry or Lake Barry, and that, and I'm going to pass a lot of things to them. I always try to, get double checked or triple checked by people. And that's one of the ways of that I have to be, that I need to do in the editing process. I don't know if that answers your question directly, but
I'm not sure what my question exactly was in that regard. It just totally fascinated me that this would be part of this deck already. It's something that I noticed a little bit in the other books as well. The other question that I had is about the Mohawk girl. You seem to give her some better, what would you call it, a foresight. And I noticed that you did that with a female character in one of the other books as well. And I am very terrible with
a couple of them. You just got to anger, bring these animals.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by that too.
But is that an aspect of culture, or is that an aspect of that simple personal fascination?
I think it's a combination of both. I think that certainly a highly treasured ability or gift in many First Nations cultures is that ability to set up difference where you're able to, differences are actually celebrated rather than pushed aside. And I'm talking often about ailments, physical and mental ailments. And so that part fascinates me. And the idea of this kind of, I would never call it writing magical realism, but there is that I love that kind of playing with that idea that something that we poo-poo in the real world, this idea of she can't see it, the future of that science fiction nonsense, actually feels real in my work is what I hope. I'll give you a little insight that the Mohawk girl, in Canada, the first Indian saint was Kathy. This is kind of a inspired by her. She could actually become this the very Catholic religious woman who was eventually painted by the Pope. And so, and we see that because all this men and you know, this kind of idea of the magical entry into the middle world, I guess, is part of that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And as I mentioned, we'll make reference and please try to find me. I'm going to be giving a lecture at the University of Alberta on the Monday and it's open to the public. And then I'll post on my, I'll try to get posted online where it'll be. And then I'm around Tuesday and Wednesday, as Dave mentioned, I would love to meet faculty and students as much as possible.
We used to let you go, but I would ask for your assurance that we get to see you soon. I think we all want to.
Can you repeat the dates?
Repeat the dates, okay. It's the two dates. I know Joseph will have office space and be present at Athabasca University Edmonton, formerly the Edmonton Learning Center, will be February 1st, Tuesday, and February 2nd, Wednesday.
Okay. But also International Week at the U of A, so you can just Google International Week, it'll come up, and Larry is in place in town.
Yeah, that's the evening of the Monday, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to be Monday at 12:30 in the afternoon. I think it's kind of over a lunchtime kind of thing.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay.
A big round of applause again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for spending a late Friday afternoon with me.
Has this been recorded? This is going to be recorded and the access to the Illuminate.
It has been recorded using Illuminate, but the audio was not the best for those online, and so the recording will reflect that as well.
The reason I ask is I know one book club here in the city is about to have a discussion on his work. And that Joseph was going to attend the American Canadian Studies Association of the United States and last November 2009, but wasn't able to make it. So I know there was a lot of interest at the conference in his work. So I was just wondering about sending that a link forward to those groups, because I would think that would be a great service for you as well.
By all means, and you know, there are limitations on what but it's better than the alternatives. It looks like we're just going to sign off, and I'll take this opportunity to thank you, Joseph. I found as a non-literature person, it was fascinating, and I held my rapt attention. So on behalf of the group here in Edmonton and Calgary and Athabasca, thank you, and we'll wave our video wave, and thanks for making this a great success. Sign up.
Thanks a lot.